General David Perkins is Commanding General of U.S. Army Training and Doctrine Command. General, thank you for your time today. Let's start with the mission of TRADOC. Tell me about what you do, what service you provide to the Army.
Yeah, so TRADOC does a number of things for the Army, and I try to use an analogy maybe that even military, but more specifically non-military people can understand. One of the monikers of TRADOC is we are the architects of the Army. So we design the future of the Army, and under General H.R. McMaster and our archaic folks, we take a look to looking out to 2025, 2040, and saying, what is the environment we're going to be operating in? What capabilities does the Army have to have as part of the joint force? What do we want our divisions to do? What our brigades do? What are the developing requirements for tanks, helicopters, all that? So they basically draw out a blueprint for the Army. We design the future, but we're also a design build firm, because then what we do is we take the blueprints and we give it to other parts of TRADOC, the next two parts that sort of get it, not that it's always sort of sequential like this, are Recruiting Command and Cadet Command. So those are two-star general commands inside of TRADOC. Recruiting Command recruits the Army. As you drive around the country and see our armed forces recruiting centers at strip malls, that's TRADOC. So we recruit all of the soldiers that come into the Army, and then Cadet Command runs all our ROTC organizations at about almost 300 schools and universities, colleges around the country. So they bring in all our soldiers and bring in all our officers. And then what we do is we send it to another two-star command, initial military training. And what they do is they conduct all of the basic training, all the advanced individual training, all the basic officer training, and they train everybody up. And then we give them out into the Army. Vast majority of them go to Forces Command, who make ready the Army. And then routinely, we bring them back into TRADOC and send them to Command General Staff College, Sergeant Major's Academy, Captain's Career Course. We give them more lessons learned and more doctrine. So what, and kind of then send them back out to be made ready. So what TRADOC does is we design the Army, we acquire the Army, we build the Army, we improve the Army. Then Forces Command makes ready the Army, and the combatant commanders fight the Army.
You are responsible for the Army operating concept.
Yes.
Tell me about that and what it is.
Yeah, so that's part of our mission, is designing the Army. So our Army operating concept does a couple of things. One, it describes the environment that we think the Army will operate in 2025, 2040. And then within the context of that operational environment, what is it that the Army has to do, in this case, to win in the complex world? What are the capabilities we have to have? And how would you sort of array them on the field? So it's really a vision of what the Army has to do to be able to win in a complex world in the future within that context of the future. So it provides the concept that then we start working the details. Okay, if we have to be able to do that, if we have to be able to present multiple dilemmas to the enemy, present multiple options to our command authority, be able to consolidate gains, be able to conduct expeditionary mover, be able to conduct entry operations and transition quickly to offensive operations. What kind of tanks do you need? What kind of helicopters do you need? What does a brigade do? What does a division do? So it sets the intellectual framework to then start building capability.
What kinds of events or issues cause you to want to go back and revisit that and realign it?
Yeah, so, we historically, the Army has these what I would call historical inflection points. They generally occur after large wars, after World War I, after World War II, Korea, Vietnam, Desert Storm, the Cold War. We say, okay, we just been through a large-scale and or long conflict. Generally what happens after periods like this, the Army gets smaller. It happens every time. But we also use the time to be very introspective and say, well, okay, we just went through a long and or large-scale conflict. What did we learn? And can we apply that to the future? We have to be careful that we are not captive to the past, but informed by the past. And then what can we glean from that to start designing the future of the Army? And so, we, for the most part, came out of Iraq. We're downsizing in Afghanistan. We're going through a period of reducing the size of the Army. We said now is the time to say, hey, if we look 20 years out from now, what have we experienced in Iraq and Afghanistan that can inform us, yet also allow us maybe to see better the future? And we've got to start putting those pieces in place right now.
Is some of that conversation happening with your partners in the other branches,
yeah,
with the intelligence community and so on?
Well, yeah. So we work very hard to make sure we have as clear a vision about this as possible. So actually, as we were writing the draft and as we started to publish it, General Odierno, the Chief of Staff of the Army, myself, we went and briefed Chief of Naval Operations and the Navy Staff, Chief of Staff of the Air Force, Commandant of the Marine Corps, came down to Fort Eustis and spent almost a day there. And we worked extensively with the intel community to say, you know what? We think in the future, this is what the enemy is going to try to do to us. These are the capabilities they're going to have. What do you think about that? So we've tried to be very collaborative about this and say, do you agree kind of with regards to the operating environment? And then is there some overall senses that this is the role the Army plays in that? And I think really that's been one of the strengths, has been the collaborative nature, because this is not one of these things you do it and it's done. It literally is intellectual groundwork that you continue to build upon. And what we try to do is continually add more partners, interagency folks, State Department folks, justice, as I said, the whole joint force, coalition members. We've had a lot of our European allies over, Mideast allies, African coalition partners have all come to TRADOC to take a look at the operating concept. I've gone over there explaining it to kind of get their take on it. So we're trying to make this a very collaborative and inclusive process.
I like the term informed by the past, because one of the stereotypes of the military is that it's always fighting the last war.
Fighting the last war, yeah. So we've been very conscious not to do that. Mm-hmm. But that's not to say there are some universal lessons you learn. For instance, when we talk about our enemies, we try very hard not to predict the next battle and who exactly it's going to be and where it's going to be. But what we try to say is, you know what? We have found that, for instance, the enemy is going to avoid our strengths. I don't care if it's in the Mideast or the Far East or Central Plains of Europe. They probably will not play to our strengths. So we need to assume that, and therefore that's why you have to have multiple options and provide multiple dilemmas, because they will avoid our strengths. They will try to emulate our capabilities. If we have night vision goggles, they'll try to get night vision goggles. If we have unmanned aerial systems, they'll try to get unmanned aerial systems. So we can't rely solely on technology, because they will try to acquire that as well. So these are lessons we have learned, but they are not unique to Afghanistan, for instance.
You list 20 Army warfighting challenges, yeah. And there are a couple of those I'd like to ask you about,
yeah.
That I found really interesting. The first that I would like to ask about is shaping the security environment.
Yeah, so we think that is a very important part of our national security strategy, and that the Army has a unique role to play in that. If we can work with potential coalition partners and allies in shaping the environment, in helping them see more clearly what their threats are, in helping them build capability. You know, one of the things TRADOC does for our Army is build capability. So we've worked with Eastern European countries as they've come into NATO and said, you know what? The backbone of the United States Army is our non-commissioned officer corps. Let us work with you and stand up a non-commissioned officer academy in your country so you can build a non-commissioned officer corps. That's helping to shape the environment. It is building capability there. Can we develop relationships with potential coalition partners so that if the time comes for us to have to operate together, we have some commonality of how we view life and how we would actually conduct operations. And so these things all occur before actual conflict breaks out. And honestly, if you do some of it right, you actually may help prevent conflict by either building capacity and or deterring aggression.
How does your experience working in that field firsthand in Iraq inform what you're doing at TRADOC?
Yeah, I think it goes quite a long ways in informing it, because a couple of things kind of jump out. I spent a lot of time in Eastern Europe after the wall came down, spent a lot of time in the Mideast working with folks kind of shaping their environment. And one thing that we've learned is that you can't replicate the U.S. Army in these parts of the world. What you have to do is you have to understand the environment they're in. You have to understand whatever limitations and or caveats they have, whether it's resourcing or policy. And then you've got to start working with them to build a solution that works in their part of the world. So again, that's not a country specific. That's kind of a universal aspect of it. The other thing that we have learned is that it's the old proverb, you give somebody a fish, they eat for the day. You teach them how to fish, they sort of eat forever, is that in most cases, when an American soldier shows up, he's very well trained, he's very well equipped, and he could probably actually just go out and do the mission himself and get it done. But what we've learned is that you've got to build that capacity, and you've got to work on building institutions in those countries so that when we leave, it can continue to sort of self-replicate itself.
Mm-hmm. The next one is that I'd like to ask about is adapting the institutional army. And I imagine that's especially critical right now as the Army's going through its size shape, we'll call it.
It is. And, of course, TRADOC is, in many aspects, a big part of the institutional army. So we're spending a lot of time on that. And there's multiple aspects to it. Part of it is getting our doctrine right, so the institutional doctrine that we teach folks is applicable to the future. Can we want our leaders to be agile and adaptive? Is our institution agile and adaptive? Can, as we learn new things around the world, can we work them quickly into our instructional methods for our young soldiers and officers when they come through? Is the way that we work with the larger institution of the Army for acquisition, for as we acquire our materiel, we're working very hard, especially from the TRADOC point of view, is better clearly determining our requirements. Can we build our requirements documents such that it allows us to be innovative and agile and acquire capability quicker? So what we have found that we want our leaders to be agile and adaptive, but making the institution agile and adaptive is a huge challenge because it's very large and it has a lot of sort of inertia that you've got to get moving in a different direction.
How do you build that, or do you plan to build that into your leadership training so that the officers that come up behind you have those traits?
So the Chief of Staff of the Army has put a big emphasis on that, and we've written a new leader development doctrine, has put out a new field manual on leader development on how to do this to make people adaptive, innovative, creative thinkers. And so if you have a training exercise, there probably shouldn't be just one solution to it, you know, a cookie cutter solution. They said, you know what, there's multiple ways to get to the objective, and there's multiple ways to get success here. It really depends upon how innovative you are. Can you leverage other capabilities that maybe just aren't organic to your organization? We are, as we run our schoolhouses, we try to get interagency folks in, civilian agencies, academicians in, so that our soldiers learn to look at the problem not just as a soldier, but from different aspects, the political aspect, the economic aspect, the coalition aspect. We work a lot with coalition partners. And so our soldiers and leaders have to be able to look at problems from very many different angles. They have to understand there's many different levers that they can pull, and there's more than one way to solve the problem. But what this does is open up the range of possibilities, and it teaches them how to look at problems differently, not just a cookie-cutter solution.
I always find the discussion of innovation in the military fascinating because I'm struck by the juxtaposition of the perception of the DoD bureaucracy on the one hand, and on the other hand, the tremendous
out on the battlefield
innovation.
Yeah, that's what everyone says. Yeah, so at the tip of the spear,
yes,
because your life depends on
absolutely.
It. You say, you know what, I used to use the bayonet for this, but now I'm going to use the bayonet for this. Uh-huh. Or I used to use my tank like this, I'm going to use it like that, because if I don't, I'll die. And everyone always laments the reduced rate of innovation as you move closer and closer to Washington, you know, from the front lines. So one of the points we have highlighted in the Army operating concept is our Army operating concept, as we look to the future, one of the big differences compared to the Army that I grew up in, the Army I grew up in was built to deal with the known problem. So I grew up in the height of the Cold War. I was sent to Germany as a lieutenant captain. They said, Perkins, this is where you can go on the inter-German border. Here's your enemy. Here's your coalition partners. Germans on this side, Brits on this side, et cetera, like that. And you just get to know them even better. So get to know something you know already better. And in a known world, you innovate for level of differentiation. Here's a T-55 tank. We're going to build a much better tank. M1 takes a long time, very expensive, but we know what the problem is. What we're saying, our operating concept deals with an unknown world. We don't know where we're going to send Lieutenant Perkins. We don't know who's on the coalition. We don't know what weapon system the enemy's going to have. So we can't focus on level of differentiation, which quite honestly, our acquisition system is built to provide level of differentiation. We have to focus on increasing the rate of innovation. How quickly can I get new things to the soldier? How quickly can I adapt what I have? And so that's what we're working on, is increasing the rate of innovation, not necessarily the level of differentiation.
You've recently updated the Army Profession Doctrine with a new chapter on the Army Ethic. What is the Army Profession Doctrine? What prompted you to want to make that update?
So we had ADP 1, Army Doctrine Publication 1, that talks about the Army. Chapter 2 was the profession. Then we put ADRP 1 out that talked about the profession and the five essential characteristics that make us a profession in and of itself. But we said, you know what? You really need to have this ethic. It's kind of a one-pager because it's very succinct and to the point. Say, what are the moral principles we believe in as an Army? And so what it really says is, what is it, who is the Army, and what is it that we do, and what are those moral principles that we abide by? And we say we really, really kind of three things that we are. We're the, you know, we honorably serve the nation, you know, as we swear allegiance to our Constitution, that even if the time comes, we would give our lives for it, as our motto says over the years, this will defend. We are honorable professions and honorable servants of our nation. We're also military experts. In other words, we are expert at our craft. We spend a lot of time honing our military skills, tactical, operational, and strategic, because that's what our nation requires of us. So, you know, flying helicopters, driving tanks, infantrymen, cyber specialists, et cetera, they need to be an expert. That's what our nation and then the other thing we do is we are stewards of the profession. We police ourselves. That if something is going on in your profession, if there is sexual harassment, if somebody is being treated without dignity and respect, somebody from the outside of the Army should not come in and tell you this is going on. You are stewards of the profession. So those are the three things we say that we are: the honorable servants of the nation, we are experts ourselves, and we are stewards of our own profession. And when you lay that out, you say these are our moral principles we abide by, and it gives people a good roadmap of what we require for them if they are to be a professional.
And I imagine that message is intended as much for external audiences, both in the United States and around the world, as it is for your
it
soldiers.
It is. It's. I mean, first of all, it's internal. We wrote it ourselves. Somebody didn't impose it upon us. So again, a sign of a profession. We are self-policing stewards. We said this is what we're holding ourselves to, and that's all cohorts of the of the Army. So it's enlisted soldiers, non-commissioned officers, officers, warrant officers, and civilians. Active, reserve, and guard. So it is the total force of the Army. But your point, I think, is very important, that while we wrote it for ourselves and we're setting our standards for ourselves, people outside the Army look at it, and it has huge impact to them, because we operate all around the world, and we are there doing shaping operations. One of the shaping operations that we do, quite honestly, is to show folks what a professional Army looks like, how you treat people with dignity and respect, how the United States Army represents the diversity of the United States of America, on and on and on. Those are very powerful ways to inform and influence other people around the world.
And back to your experience in Iraq, I imagine that the modeling that you and your forces provided was as important as the training itself.
I think it's probably almost even more important, to tell you the truth. In a previous assignment, I went to would go to Eastern Europe, and we're standing up non-commissioned officer academies to our new NATO members. And so we'd bring them to our academy, and we'd say, okay, let's talk about the non-commissioned officer corps. This, you know, so we'd have, you know, the ubiquitous PowerPoint slide. This is the NCO creed. This is what NCOs do and everything like that. And I remember one of the chiefs of staff of the country said, you know what, I got it, all this. He said, what I want you to do is I want you to send me like an infantry company. Just send me a company so I can sit there and watch how it all works together. Like, and when we did it, like, okay, now I see what the first sergeant does. Now I see what the platoon sergeants do. Very powerful. I see how the officers interact with the soldiers and the non-commissioned officers. Now I see why you say the NCOs are the backbone of the Army. So it's one thing to kind of give people a book and read it and say that, but when they see an American Army unit in action, their eyes open up. They say, well, this whole idea of a professional force, of non-commissioned officers upholding their part of the profession, of officers holding, they said, That's so powerful. In other words, they realize that is the secret sauce of the U.S. Army. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have great helicopters and tanks and rifles and stuff, but the secret sauce are the professional soldiers in our ranks.
We've talked a little bit about building the next generation of Army leaders, and yeah. I want to expand on that. What are the most important tools, in your view, General McMaster's view, General Odierno's yeah. view, of making sure that the men and women who come behind you are as prepared as you folks are to be able to lead the Army in 2025, 2050?
Yeah, I'd go back to the first question, this issue of the profession. Mm-hmm. I have found, having served in combat multiple times now, more than probably any of us want, that is the heart of it. That if you've got to have this buy-in to the profession, this sense of selfless service, honorable service to the nation, that is critical. Because when the chips are laid down with it and everything comes to a head, in the end, that's you are relying on your warrior ethos, your ethic, and all that to do the right thing. Because in combat, you have split seconds to make life and death situations, and a lot of external motivators are taken away at that point in time, and what you're relying on is your internal inspiration that you have as being a member of this profession. So I think that's absolutely critical. The second thing that is key, we talked about already, for our success is, as you said, leader development. So we've got to invest in our soldiers, non-commissioned officers, and officers from an early age. And we start it at basic training now to say, you know what? You're coming into a very unknown world. You're coming into a world that changes very rapidly. So you've got to be a critical thinker. You have to be able to operate within our intent, yet be able to seize, retain, and exploit the initiative. And we are requiring you to be an expert, a military expert. You have to spend time developing yourself. So we kind of have three realms of leader development. There's sort of the operational realm is routing units. There's the institutional realm that I run. And then there's the self-development domain, which we think is equally important. And we're actually putting an emphasis on that. And it's probably, in some cases, universally been the least leveraged to say, look, if you are a profession, you have to develop yourself. In other words, I can't teach you everything you need to know, and especially keep you updated mm-hmm. at the rate of change. I can't bring you back into the schoolhouse every now and then. So what is your ability to continue to improve yourself, to work on your self-development domain? And that because the rate of change is getting so great in the world, we have to have people that learn quickly, learning organizations, and we have to be able to adapt and increase our rate of innovation faster than other folks. And you've got to start that when they first come in the Army and say, that's my expectation. You're going to continually prove yourself every single day. Part of it's on us, but part of it's on you.
I hear opportunities in there potentially for soldiers who choose to do so to not necessarily feel they have to be on an officer track if they choose not to be. Do you foresee an opportunity where someone can come into the Army, spend a long career there, but not necessarily be subject to up or out?
Well, a number of things we're taking a look at is our developmental models, are they still applicable for the future? They were sort of, in some ways, they're kind of industrial age models, legacy models. And especially for some of the new, capability we want in the Army, cyber is one that comes up all the time. We just stood up the cyber branch. It's the newest branch, the last branch we stood up in the Army was Special Forces, so we don't do that very often. Mm-hmm. And we're saying, you know what, a lot of the skill sets in cyber, they could be resident out in the civilian world, industry, whatever. Maybe we could bring those people laterally into the Army because we don't necessarily – they may not find themselves in a foxhole or taking a hill, but it's an important capability to have. And there may be different motivators why those people want to come in the Army. They may want a different career track. And so the goodness is, as we are looking at the cyber career field, it is giving us insights into, you know what, there's probably different ways we want to develop folks. Now, what we have to do is we have certain statutory and regulatory requirements on DOTMA and all that, which really are kind of industrial age or legacy models. So we are taking a look. I know Secretary Carson, previous Undersecretary of the Army, is taking this on OSD and saying, you know what, we got to look differently about talent management and how we work our human capital. So I think it's a huge growth industry. I think we're just nicking the surface of the possibilities. But I think There is a lot of room for an improvement and change in that area.
Last question, sir. How much of a future Army leader's mission will be communicating to the rest of the 99% of the country that don't serve in the military what life is like in the military, what the mission is, and the benefit that the military provides to the country, to the folks that don't really have any connection or contact?
Yeah, I think that's a mission every day of our soldiers. And we're getting better at it, but I think we need to even be better. And I wouldn't say just a leader. I will tell you, I've had, you know, enlisted soldiers, sergeants go up on Capitol Hill, Sergeant Major of the Army daily, had some, I think, last week going up there, the not my squad. And I got to tell you, those soldiers and NCOs, they were much more powerful than myself going up, because honestly, when generals show up, they kind of expect a certain, I don't know, maybe kind of boilerplate explanation of things. But when you talk to soldiers who are in squads or platoon sergeants or first sergeants or something, they're going to tell you like it is. That's the genius of the United States Army, is we're full of great Americans from the United States, and they're pretty much what you see is what you get, and they'll tell it like it is. And that's very powerful. So I would say it's extremely important that we describe the United States Army to the people of the United States of America. And I think every soldier has a role in it, that they describe their part of it and then what they know about it. And I think there's no powerful way to get the message out. Because I think it's very important, because, you know, Congress is sort of our board of directors. The American people are our stockholders. And they need to understand what their Army is about, why their sons and daughters go into the Army, and we need to know what they expect of the Army. That's what a profession is. I said that we are the sort of honorable servants of our nation, and that's our nation.
Finally, I want to give equal time where equal time is due. I want you to complete this phrase, please, because I ask this of all the Army and Navy folks that I talk to. Go Army.
Beat Navy.
Correct. Thank you very much, General Perkins.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate the time today.